If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
The Sound Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. We'll be doing many live events this summer around the country, which will include artist interviews, contests, and more. Sign up for our newsletter at osirispod.com to stay in the loop. Relix Magazine is a media partner of OSIRIS. For more, visit relix.com. The show starts now. You've been listening to Alligator Bride from Howlin' Rain, the title track from their upcoming release. Ethan Miller, the principal behind Howlin' Rain, is one of those dudes who doesn't just write and make great music, he makes a lot of it. Not only that, but aside from writing and composing the band's music, he also oversees virtually all facets of getting his music to you via his own imprint, Silver Current Records. He is a fascinating individual who is involved in several bands and writes poetry in his downtime. Each band has its own distinct brand of rock, and Ethan Miller is careful not to blur the lines of each band's intent. We recently sat down with Ethan Miller to talk about classic rock powerhouse Howlin' Rain's fifth full-length release, and the conversation twisted and turned into a very poignant one that I think you'll enjoy. Our conversation started when I asked Ethan Miller about what inspired him to put out this record now.
Well, we kind of got it out as fast as we could, and it took a minute. We recorded it in all coincidence on the eve of the U.S. presidential elections in November of 2016, and we actually recorded the bulk of the songs on the day of the election.
Wow.
And finished up most of the tracking that after the election results had come in, for the most part. And okay, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of come out of the studio days, you know, what's going on the Twitter there, Justin? well, probably not what you want to hear, you know, but since I've been putting these records out, doing the Howlin' Rain record here on Alligator Bride on my label Silver Current Records.
Right.
And I put out the Feral Ohms record, which is another one of my bands, kind of more of a Black Flag meets Hendrix kind of band. And I've kind of like tried to get the production down to a nice paced level so that everything can be of quality and nothing's rushed. And here comes the tour. We don't have the records in time. And you know, whatever, you know how it goes. So
right.
From 2016, when we, you know, finished, or when we kind of wrapped up the record in early 2017, I was out on the road with Hair and Oblivion quite a bit and finishing up the Feral Ohms record. And so I said, okay, let's let everything have its place and time. And then we'll move towards this Howlin' Rain record. And, you know, here we are a year and a half later, and we found it's time. We finally come to the future.
When it's an amazing coincidence that you tracked this record or made this record the night of the election, when something like that hits and the news is probably not necessarily what you guys wanted to hear. Is there a thought to go back and rework some of the material or write some new material as kind of what the fuck?
Well, you know what? I had an interesting experience with that because luckily it didn't need any rewriting. Sometimes you write songs and you don't, you know, there's no way to say so. It's sounding a little astrological or mystical or something, but
right.
You know, you're not sure exactly what they're about. Like if someone's like, who's that? Name the person that's about or name the exact place or incident. You're like, I don't know. I grasped what for me was a poetic truth in the writing of this song. And I'm not, you know, not exactly sure where all that came from or what, you know, what the exact deal is. And that was the song Alligator Bride,
right?
You know, which was, I kind of wrote, you know, in a sort of poetic brainstorm about this, you know, American history, what it means to be standing on this little piece of, you know, there's something about our moment in history right now that even before that election, to me, felt like kind of like in one of those old, you know, kind of Bugs Bunny cartoons or something where the whole earth falls away and Bugs Bunny or the Roadrunner or whatever is just standing on this one little tiny piece of earth, like 1,000 feet high with sort of space and lava,
right,
and all this primordial, you know, nothingness all around them. And something about the way that, you know, I felt like I'd lived, you know, when I was born and when I was, growing up pre-internet in a small town, I was still basically living, you know, in an old, you know, American paradigm that was something that wasn't that far from, you know, the 1950s, the 60s, or, you know, really even the 30s or 40s in that town. You know, right. Kids rode their bicycles around the streets, and yes, someone had, you know, walked on the moon, and we had telephones and televisions and stuff, but, you know, basically this was still a kind of older vision of the world. And now I live in a very fast-paced, you know, sort of what I think of as the future world, which is digital, and you know, we're kind of becoming estranged from our own history, and in some ways estranged from our own future.
Right.
Because we can't quite comprehend it, and nor are we quite sure when we, you know, where the present is anymore. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the digital revolution and us incorporating, you know, making our lives digital, living online, living in the phones, living in the social media world and the technology world, is the present and the future and the past are all, you know, arranged in a different way. And I feel like we don't have a clear concept of, you know, where exactly those things are anymore. You don't feel them the same way that, you know, you did pre-digital, where you're like, I know exactly where the present is. I'm standing in the middle of a small town somewhere,
right,
you
right.
know, wishing I was, you know, up, you know, I don't know, doing something exciting or whatever, but I'm just kicking an old can, you know, down the sidewalk. You're very much there. You're very real and in the moment and living that present moment to the fullest. Anyways, all that is to say, and I'm side winding, meandering.
No, it's good.
Tale is that, you know, Alligator Bride was a song trying to take a look at that, and also bring in some of, you know, some of the elements of how complex our general political ideology had become at that point, and the truths and the false histories and the complexities and the glory and the violence and the, you know, all that of what, you know, what it is to be an American standing in the middle of this moment and trying to be American in the first place and try to make sense of your history is an incredibly complicated thing. Because it, you know, there's so much thread intertwining and then so many different dialogues going on about what the truth of history was, what we needed to cover up for shame, what we needed to raise up for glory, even if it wasn't, and vice versa, the things right. that got looked over that are glorious and whatnot. So, you know, trying to just poetically boil some of this stuff down in a kind of small song, poem, dreamscape, to three verses and a few choruses. and when you do that, you try to just endow the song with a resonant emotion that right. expresses those things and hopefully triggers, you know, I want a feeling of lost history, lost time, nostalgia, longing, and also, you know, kind of a battered, you know, leaning into the wind of the chaos of now and future that you're never gonna be able to get your hands on, you know, completely. So that song, you know, I felt like I'd sort of done that, and I thought, okay, cool, you know, and I had some sort of you know, kind of circus imagery too, like small town and a little bit of America, maybe a little Cormac McCarthy imagery in there and stuff. But, and the Alligator Bride was one of the characters in this song that's at the circus or whatever. That's just supposed to be kind of a titillating concept, you know, that
right.
the Wolf Man, the Alligator Bride, the, you know, the crazy stuff at the circus in the peep show or the freak show or wherever it is, you know, you know, we recorded the song and kind of late night came out and the whole American political landscape. And beyond that, I think the real shock about that was for a lot of people was that, you know, the cultural conversation was different than what we thought we were talking about. We knew we had complexities here that we were trying to work through and in some cases trying to bash through, you know, but, you know, it just turned the blender on ultra high from this swirling cultural conversation to this, you know, there was a violence to it. And I don't mean just in the aftermath of the election and the violence that sometimes happened at rallies or anything like that. I mean, a violence of interpretation, you know, right. This wasn't something even that most of the pundits or most of us as citizens or people on any side of the line looking over the line at, you know, all of a sudden, you know, oh my God, we got to draw lines in the sand. You're looking out the window at your neighbor who's over there. What's going on out there? You know, so as far as having to rework a song, I didn't, because all of a sudden that song had just become so much more endowed with everything I'd already endowed it with. It just was four times as loaded, you know, right. And all of a sudden I went back and looked at those lines and looked at what the song was about and thought it just got a lot more about what it was about, you know? So, I don't know. I kind of had one of those experiences, and people talk about that in songwriting when they say, well, a lot of times you write something and the subject matter of the song is yet to be revealed and you move towards it and then it happens and you know that you can't really explain it. I don't necessarily think it's, you know, I don't know, you know, some people believe that you don't have, you know, that time isn't necessarily, especially in an artistic sense, that time isn't necessarily completely linear,
right,
trajectory. And in that case, that's one of the reasons why, you know, these weird bits of sound frequency have so much resonance to us, because they're unlike, you know, film or something like that. They're capturing a different, you know, different pieces of time and stuff. So I don't know what happened there, but I didn't have to rewrite anything because of massive changes in the world culture, you right. know, and a lot's happened since November 16th, 2000.
But it still holds up, right? I mean, it still holds up.
It does. And you know what? I mean, it's the world is moving so fast and the changes are so bombastic and the things that are going on. For 8 years, we had Barack Obama as president, who, you know, in my estimation is a much better president and a much more suited person to lead a country, you know, like the United right. States, as in a public service capacity.
Right.
Than the person that we have in there now, who isn't fit to lead in any kind of public service capacity. I mean, president aside, you know, he's not interested in public service. So, no. You know, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, having a different president didn't make the United States any less complex.
Totally.
You know, so that song was at my thinking and sorting out of the American story was, you know, no simpler before, you know, the president changed over. So
juxtaposed to this idea of thinking about the future or even the time we're living in is the sound of this band, which is a throwback to 35 years ago, 40 years ago, you know, or Europe 72 from the Dead or Free Music, or it just has that real mid-70s feel to it. And then on top of that, you're putting current day experience on top of that. I mean, is that because the music that you prefer or the music that the band prefers fits in kind of there? Like I hear Norman Greenbaum. I hear all kinds of things on this record and I think, wow, you know, there's the lyrics and the stories are so enlightening, and yet it's up against this stuff that's, while timeless, still from an older time.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, that's a bigger debate too about whether, you know, what are the guidelines that make music retro or not. You know, right. I mean, nobody wants to create music that can only exist in a, you know, museum type setting, because it has no innovation, and it's just purely authentic for the point of being authentic to a certain time period or style of playing.
Right.
In order, I think that's what Howlin' Rain is, or anything that I do. But I do feel like the thing that Howlin' Rain music has in common with that era of music is, you know, actually that there was a lot of, there weren't, you know, people weren't putting a lot of rules on their music in that kind of 67 to, you know, 75 era. That was a very free time for experimentation that was still linked to different kinds of Western roots music, sometimes even Eastern, you know, they bring in Eastern influences, but I think American, you know, blues and swing and rhythm and blues and stuff, you know, that was, you know, when you talk about the Grateful Dead or, you know, Led Zeppelin or the Beatles or anybody, that's, you know, that there was a lot of mixing and matching and mashing and experimentation. Doesn't sound like as much now. We don't call that, you know, experimental music. We call it classic rock or whatever, but, but, you know, truly at the time that was, you know, one of the elements that we find so engaging is that there weren't strict guidelines to, like, this, you know, punk music, you know, these are basic guidelines that critics understand about punk music. And if it runs too far out of that, it goes away, you know, into a different genre, into new wave, or, you know, if it's got this and this, it becomes hip hop, you know? I feel like there was a window of time, you know, and jazz before that was doing that from the, you know, what, the 50s to the late 60s. They were doing things that confounded the critics and people that would put genre guidelines. They, oh, well, yeah, it is still jazz, but, you know, as far as these subgenres or how we can place it, they're pulling all these different things into it, and just, you know, being free with it while still, you know, growing out of the roots, you know, the basic roots of the music. So I am fond of that time because, you know, I find it to be, you know, or I think what I have in common with those sounds and times is that, you know, I'm fond of the kind of roots music of rock and roll.
Right.
And then being able to move, you know, freely within that to make it, you know, funky or a little heavier or a little whatever, and have melody, you know, move in there to have, you know, melody be at the forefront as well. So, you know, I have other things that are more experimental, and those are, it's really fun to create like improvised experimental music that, often defies melody or is fiercely opaque, or concrete. And I do that as well. But, you know, there's in certain bands, at least for me, you know, I find that you have to use your weather vane as to what is the spirit of this thing you've given life to. You've given this Howlin' Rain a name. And over here in this other band I'm in Inherent Oblivion, we've given it a name, a spirit, and a character. And we know when we're creating songs in there, or even riffs, when something isn't quite right for the character, or a little false to the character, you know, almost like you have a Frankenstein and, you know, you tell it to do certain things and you're like, ah, you know, that thing where we're having the Frankenstein, you know, do the funny dance or whatever, like, that's not what Frankenstein does.
right.
But have Frankenstein try to pick the flower at the edge of the lake, and then the little girl come up on him, and that sounds as weird and lilting as dancing, but somehow it's like, oh my God, that's the most profound thing we could have had Frankenstein do, you know? And it's different than just having him hold his arms out and like walk around like a zombie, which kind of works in certain, you know, that works also. But so, you know, same with the band. So the long answer is for Howlin' Rain, you know, you have a basic form and understanding of the things that your Frankenstein will do. And then you try to look for the most elevated and beautiful things it can do, which are the most special, and get a few of those flower by the lake moments with the, you know, with the child thing going too. So
I would imagine, though, it's also important to understand the makeup of each band in terms of what the players are capable of doing for each song. I mean, when you have a guy who plays slide guitar like Daniel does, it's probably a lot different than what you know, the outfit in Odyssey Cult does. I mean, it's different players, and being able to bring these songs to life in a special way relies on the ability of the people that you kind of have in the fold in each band, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a second layer to a band with a revolving cast. You know, if you're in Hal and Rain a much more historical band, for example, is like Mick Fleetwood is doing that in Fleetwood Mac, and you've listened to Rumors and put it back to back with, then played on like Fleetwood Mac's second or third record or something, right, when it's a whole different group of people, except for the rhythm section, a whole different manner of playing. It's not pop or whatever, but how does that catalog stay true? And there really isn't a place in there where in an entire, you know, Fleetwood Mac catalog where you go, yeah, that wasn't it. You know, that's weird. They did the rap album or something in there and that was wrong. You know, like he had a brilliant, I'm assuming, you know, it's him. And then also, you know, him, you know, leaving his weather vane up for if the band is like, it's kind of weird, like this isn't right or something. But, you know, that's all Fleetwood Mac. I mean, it makes it amazing. And I try to do that with Hal and Rain too, to be really sensitive. That's in the song process. When I take songs in, now I'm a little older and hopefully a tiny bit wiser in certain areas, mm-hmm. you know, that if I take a riff in or a song in and present it to the band and they, you know, usually that first time through or second, maybe if I'm like, oh, let's try one more run through. And, you can tell if they just come to life and start breathing the band language into it, it's happening. If not, then, you know, let's keep working with the strengths here. There's plenty of songs to be played, and put that away. Maybe it goes somewhere else, or maybe you'll see it again someday. But, you know, that's how you deal with that. Just try to, just see when the band's really speaking and breathing, you know, when they're playing songs.
You are taking the show on the road, and I mean, this is an impressive 28 date. It says here U.S. tour, but that's a lie because you're coming to Toronto.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
It's okay. I'm sure I'm one of the few Torontonians that actually see the press release. But the point is that, I mean, this is a big thing. I mean, this is not just putting out a record and letting it breathe on its own. You're taking the record to the people, as you've always done, and you've always, you know, spent time on the road. This is 2 months away from reality, right? I mean, this is 2 months away from not doing your everyday. Is that daunting before you get in a van with these people?
No, I mean, because my everyday works towards doing that for the everyday. So, you know, as a professional musician, you're either practicing, recording, or you're on the road.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of your life, you know, and you, of course, everybody that does that stays in it year after year and then decade after decade, they love doing that for their life,
right?
You know? So, and even I feel like when you're younger, and sometimes, you know, it's harder to tour because you don't really, you know, you don't have your tour is just this explosive partying and whatever. you know, it's harder. There's a few hours every night that are amazing when you're young, you know, that you're like, oh, the playing and the getting totally wasted. So that's awesome. And then the other like 18 hours of the day are just like sheer hungover, like boredom, anger, fear, you know, at the repercussions of the evening. And at some point, you know, after a decade passes or something and you're moving into your second decade of doing it, you're like, okay, that's my life out there. You know, if my life, you know, and if you've moved on past your life just being, you know, one explosive meltdown of booze and drugs after another day to day or whatever, then you're right. Let's transpose that to the tour life and find out how elevated and how fun this can be, you know, and sometimes you got to create interesting, you know, things to do out there. You know, I started writing more poetry and taking photographs with antique cameras and stuff, so that when you're in these places that sometimes could feel like, well, here I am in nowhere, you know, Iowa or whatever, and you know, 7 hours till the gig, we got in early, there's nothing to do, whatever. Well, you know, if you're like, let's make this my life, let's go out and find some stories and take some pictures and, you know, go see like what's, try to dig in and see what's special about this place a little bit, you know, that, you know, all of a sudden you can start, you know, mapping your country, you know, right. Mapping your day to day a little bit as a actual journey and something that's fascinating, you know. Well, and when you're just tending to try to survive
hangover, right,
you know, that's all off the table, you know. So I mean, I think finding the perfect balance of having fun and you know, partying a little bit at the show, and then finding the exact place where you can do that, still go to bed at 4 a.m still get up at 9:30 a.m have the, you know, have the 6 hour drive or whatever, and then have your 3 hours in the you know, whatever town in Iowa or something to go and do that and be able to enjoy that and have that actually, other than the hour and a half on stage, have that, you know, that little time there where you get to drink in, you know, this town or the culture or the people that are sitting next to you at lunch or whatever. So
it's a lot like the life is imitating art, because I mean, much like you discuss, you know, standing in the eye of that tornado storm in terms of the music that you're writing and coming to grips with the reality around you, it's the same for tour life. I mean, it is a storm, right? I mean, whether it's drinking yourself silly at night or figuring out how to drive the next day or how to make it to soundcheck the next day. I mean, it is always that kind of that balance of everything.
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that, you know, you're also, when you're in a band out on the road, you know, as human beings out there in the community and in the culture and at the truck stops, at the whatever, you're kind of like a herd of unicorns too, like moving through the world. Like people, you're moving through mostly stationary lives, you know, rubbing up against people that are, I mean, in the moment that you rub up against them, you know, you get in the afternoon in this town in Iowa or whatever, and go to the bookstore and go to lunch. And, you know, you're interacting with a lot of people that are at their jobs or at the diner for lunch. And they will be again tomorrow at that same location and, or at least in that town or whatever, you know, you're going to them night after night to a different place and moving through a much, much more stationary and slower culture as you move at the highest speed that you possibly can for the longest distances you possibly can from place to place every night and do the most that you can for those people in your interaction that you can possibly wring out of yourself. And then, you know, do the longest distance and the to the next. And that's an interesting, yeah. I mean, to come back to the, you know, weird thing about, you know, time slippage. And that's a very interesting thing to slide into. Of course, in New York City, you know, when you're in Manhattan, it's around Christmas time or something like that. things are moving. There's a lot of energy, and people don't take, you know, as much notice of a band, you know, or whatever, right. Or people like, oh, hey, look, those guys aren't from around here. You know, nobody says that in Manhattan, you know, because everybody, it's just so like, what's going on here? This is amazing. But, you know, a lot of the places that you go, you know, out there,
Raccoon Motel in Davenport, Iowa. You stick out like a sore thumb, probably.
I have no idea because I don't, I'm not sure, but yeah, it's different. It's different than Oakland. It's different than Manhattan, you know?
Yeah.
I have been through Davenport before, but I don't think we played there before, but I did go there to do a day trotter session. And yeah, I remember it, you know, looking like a small town. This is an alligator bride town from another era. You know, this is, you know, there was a train whistling, you know, through the dark of night at the edge of town. And, you know, you could tell that it was, you know, that this was, hey, you know, since I've been there 8 years ago or whatever, yes, it's very possible that it's a hive of tech entrepreneurs.
Yes. Yes. It's a metropolis, you know, for sure.
So sometimes you go back and you're like, oh, there's all these fancy places that Guy Fieri's been to eat or something on a TV show already, you know. So the worst that can happen if these highly interesting places gentrify, then, you know, at least you're drinking good coffee on
right.
your downtime.
There you go.
So, not to be crass about gentrification,
no.
But, you know, that stuff's seen transformation over 20 years. I mean, I've been like touring through Detroit for 20 years now, right. Or maybe 17, 18 years, something like that, you know, and, you know, it changes every time I go. And sometimes it was changing for the worse and they were falling under very hard times. You know, they were in kind of rough shape before the city went bankrupt in the economic near collapse in 2008.
Yeah.
And after that, yeah, it was really, really rough for them. And now I think things are turning around a bit, but they have their questions about how it turns around, how it's rebuilt, what happens to the people that all stuck it out when the city got down to tiny numbers, you know, compared to the, you know, bustling metropolis it once was. And now tech companies and things are just like busting in and, you know, flying in, you know, hundreds of new young kind of money making employees and stuff. And, you know, all those complexities are a fascinating thing to be able to witness and to see, you know, and to clock over time a little bit.
And to write about, probably. And to write about a little bit. Not specifically. Yeah.
Sometimes you move so fast you can't really understand these, you know, you can't really understand it all. You sort of just absorb a bit and ask the locals what's going on and stuff. But, you know, other places you have a little deeper connection and you really feel invested.
This was a fascinating discussion, something that, you know, we don't really get to check the pulse of the people making music or what's on their brain. Too often we get down to the weeds of the recording process or the songs. But, you know, to be able to sit down and talk to somebody who's lived this, you know, experience for so long and has seen so much of the country was truly a great time. And so I thank you for it because it's very insightful and very intriguing. And certainly, you know, Alligator Bride, the record drops June 8th. And you're doing this tour and people will be able to go to the website and check out the tour. I mean, you're hitting, is there a nook and cranny or not? Basically, you're doing the West and then you're moving East and there's nowhere and everywhere in between, right? I mean, you're not missing anywhere.
We're going to put, I think, a third leg of tour that we're working on that kind of runs back out and does the Midwest, runs back out to Chicago. And we kind of missed some of the Western middle area. So I think by the end of the year, you know, if we can get those other legs on there, we'll have covered a lot of ground there and hopefully, yeah, you know, 3, 4, 5 Canadian shows too, and stuff, which we'll call U.S. touring.
Well, we're proud to be your saner, more normal neighbors to the north for now.
And, yeah, I love coming up. I love coming up.
And we'll for sure try and see you when you're up here. But thanks for taking the time, man. I'm really appreciated, and the record's really great. We'll spin a couple tunes on the show here, and thanks for this. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks a ton. It was great talking to you.
That discussion leaves a lot to unpack, and for good reason. Ethan Miller is both thoughtful and provocative, and those sentiments come across in all his work. I should mention that Alligator Bride is part of the Mansion Trilogy, so you want to have a listen to 2016's Mansion Songs to get a better understanding of what Howlin' Rain is up to. The Mansion, by the way, is where this album and its predecessor were recorded in San Francisco. With a jam-packed June and July in the offing, you may want to check out HowlinRain.com for dates in your area and a lot more stuff on the band. Before we leave you, have a listen to The Wild Boys, a song that pays homage to William Burroughs and his book of the same name.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.
Osiris.